Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll hear about summer learning opportunities for Central Ohio students. I'll speak with an expert about sports gambling, just in time for the Memorial Tournament. We'll also learn more about eczema from a dermatologist, and Jay Fox will speak with someone about trade jobs in Central Ohio. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Here in Franklin County, there are as many as 120,000 school-aged children enrolled in public and private schools. That's a lot of kids needing something to do over the summer. A new study titled The Summer Struggle is based on interviews with more than 30,000 parents of school-aged children across the United States. And as Congress works on the fiscal 27 budget, federal funding for after-school and summer learning programs remains in question. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective is Jody Grant. She's the executive director of the After School Alliance, and also Gigi Antoni, vice president of youth development at the Wallace Foundation. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. Jody, I'm going to start with you. What did the new After School Alliance study find?
So our study, which is appropriately entitled The Summer Struggle for Families, finds that far too many of our families, so for every child that is in a summer program, there's another child whose parents wants them to be in a program that is not, that these programs are just out of reach for far too many of our families. So say 50% of the kids whose parents want them in programs are not in programs, and it's even higher in Ohio. In Ohio, it's 60% of our students whose parents want them to be in programs don't have access, and cost is the biggest barrier.
So when we look at that 120,000 school-aged children in Franklin County, are you telling me that as many as 80,000 of those kids are without?
Yeah, if you look at the numbers for the state of Ohio, if you use the same 60%, that's what we're looking at. And we're looking at, you know, many of those parents, they want it because of the great experiences it is for their children to have a summer experience, but it's also they're working, so it's creating undue stress on them that their children have nowhere to go.
Not to mention the fact that there are safety concerns as well. Now, Gigi, why are families in need of these summer programs? Why is it so important beyond the obvious?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is, as you said, there are safety concerns. Summer and after school are the times where you see the most kids getting in trouble. But you also see kids as victims, you know, the most time that kids are vulnerable to crime as well. So there's that. The other is that summer is a time when learning continues to happen. So kids who have access to high-quality summer programs are more prepared for the following year. There's a loss or even a gain that can happen in summer, so the kids continue to learn, they continue to be engaged, and they're more prepared for the school in September.
How does the Wallace Foundation support efforts when funding isn't there?
So the Wallace Foundation is a private, you know, philanthropy, and so we join forces with other private investments in summer that are local, state, and national investments in the private sector, and partner with public investments. There isn't enough private sector money in the world to solve this problem for every kid, so public funding is very, very important. And so we also are supporting communities and talking to their elected officials and coming together to coordinate across county, school, and city resources, along with their private sector investments.
Now, let's go back to Ohio for a minute. You said that Ohio is 10% higher than the national average at 60%. Did the study determine why?
The study didn't go into that, but I can tell you that Ohio is one of the states that doesn't invest anywhere near the level of other states at the state level. So we have multiple states that have state funding streams, so that helps to a degree in making spots available for more of our kids.
So we have an interesting problem here in Franklin County. Franklin County is obviously where the capital is, Columbus, which is the largest metropolitan city in the state of Ohio. But there's also a tremendous amount of rural area in the county. The problem of summer programming and after-school programming, as you said, middle and low-income people being hit the hardest, we have such rural poverty in Ohio. Have we determined whether this is an urban problem or rural problem, or does it know no boundaries?
No, it doesn't know any boundaries. I mean, the problems are in every community, and the lack of programs are in every community. But I do think rural programs face some struggles that are greater or different than other communities, and that's actually in our report. And transportation is a much bigger barrier for our rural communities. But there's some amazing programs. And so even in rural communities, looking to local resources, so parks and recs, libraries, community centers, local businesses, there's some extraordinary programs out there, but very much. And when we look at the federal funds, which is what, you know, Ohio relies on, they're going to rural, suburban, and urban communities. It's so, not enough.
So when we talk about not having enough money, as we know, every major school district is facing a budget deficit. They've turned to levies. Levies have failed. They've turned to the government for additional support. The state government has said, we don't have any money. Even the federal government is saying, we don't have any money. How do we make a case for after-school and summer programming ahead of all the other things that everyone else is in line with their handout for?
So I think one of the great things about after school and summer is that we have the data that shows that every investment saves, you know, between $3 and $9 down the road. And so it's a relatively modest investment when you're thinking about the cost of an after school or summer program that is helping our children succeed for the future. It's a lifeline for working parents because it allows them to be more productive and to keep their jobs. And it's really critical to our business community, whether it's the current workforce, which is their parents, but also the future workforce, which is the students that we're providing all of these resources and opportunities to think about and prepare them for the careers of the future.
I just also want to add that, you know, it's not like summer is trying to solve a different problem than a school district's trying to solve or a city's trying to solve. I mean, we have plenty of evidence that, you know, summer programs that combine academics and enrichment move the needle for kids in math and reading and help them discover and learn new things. So it's not as if it's a different kind of investment. It's not as if it's a different investment than going to school. It is a learning investment, and it actually leverages and increases the impact of other investments that are being made in young people's learning.
Has this been an ongoing problem, or was there a time in the history of our country where we figured this out?
That's a great question.
I think it's an ongoing problem, but I do think that that what we've seen, and definitely in this study, is that more and more parents want these programs for their kids. So demand has gone up. And as well, when you're talking about, you know, voters, which matters, voters across the board and parents across the board, whether they are Republican, Democrat, or independent, they want public investments in this space to increase. And I think that number has, in the every 5 years that we've done this study, that number consistently goes up.
So for the listeners who have heard our discussion over the last 10 minutes or so, if they want to learn more, if they want to make a donation, if they want to get involved in some way, shape, or form, what is the first step? What's that web address?
AfterSchoolAlliance.org.
And WallaceFoundation.org.
All right. We want to thank Jody Grant from the After School Alliance and Gigi Antoni from the Wallace Foundation for sharing their thoughts and the results of that survey. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Derek Longmire is executive director of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio.
And you may not think of gambling right off the bat when you think about the Memorial Tournament, but as he's about to tell us, it probably is something we should consider. Hi, Derek. How are you today?
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. First off, will you tell us a little bit about the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio and the work that you do?
I'd be happy to. PG&O is a statewide organization that was founded in 2010, but really predates the Ohio Council in the early 1980s. And our focus is really to make sure that resources are available to all Ohioans as it relates to gambling, whether that's professionals who are preventionist clinicians or as those that might benefit from receiving gambling services from either youth from a prevention lens or youth and adults from both prevention and clinical perspectives.
Okay. And we are about to embark upon a pretty big week here in Central Ohio in the springtime. It means the Memorial Tournament, and you may not think of gambling right off the bat when you hear about a big golf event, but as you can attest, that isn't necessarily the case, right?
Certainly not the case, and especially now that we have legalized sports betting in Ohio for the last 3 years or so. If any television showing of the tournament, you're going to see likely some odds from DraftKings or FanDuel about the ways that you can bet. And it's just an easy game to bet on because there's a set amount of players and they're going to have strokes and points and just easy things to bet on.
And you touched on it briefly, but the preponderance of mobile betting apps has probably increased the rate of gambling on events like the Memorial Tournament, haven't they?
They certainly have, and we know that there's kind of three elements related to increased engagement in an activity. So access is one, availability is one, as well as just the shift that we're seeing related to kind of cultural acceptance. And with sports betting now being legalized, much more available, we have almost 20 different mobile sports book operators. It's just very prevalent and prominent in the state.
So mobile betting apps have definitely increased the gambling activity around the state of Ohio. What are some warning signs that people should be on the lookout for if they or a loved one are involved with the apps and not sure that it's a good idea?
For the individual who are placing those bets, the first question is to really ask yourself, is this still fun? As we're looking at sports betting, it should be a leisure activity like it would be playing a round of golf or seeing a movie. So again, asking yourself, is that still fun? And then also really looking at being able to set those limits of both dollar spent as well as time spent. For those loved ones, many times they're the ones that identify the gambling problem more than the gambler because they're kind of in their own little box and the gambler themselves. So really being good listeners and really making sure that you're asking questions and somebody seems to be preoccupied with gambling, they don't have any money that seems to be unexplained, then those can be some warning signs as well.
What's a good first step for, say, a loved one who's observing some things they may be concerned about, but maybe they're worried about approaching that person? They aren't sure how they're going to react. What's a good kind of first step or opening of a conversation like that?
Well, there's a great resource to begin with, and our statewide campaign is Pause Before You Play, website pausebeforeyouplay.org. And the focus there is really before you make that first bet or place that next bet, to pause and really be prepared for what that might look like. For the loved one who may be interested in having this conversation, resources are also available through the Pause campaign to kind of help with those conversation starters and really approaching from a perspective of care and wanting to ensure that the individual is getting help for the problem. And that help can look very different depending on kind of what their needs are. So just being a good listener and recognizing that gambling is an addiction like with substance use. We see a lot of correlation with substance use and mental health disorders. So recognizing that it's not a character flaw. This is a physical condition. And then also just the importance of navigating and getting access to those resources.
You mentioned the website. It's pausebeforeyouplay.org, correct?
Correct.
And what other types of resources are available there for either someone that's concerned their gambling may be becoming a problem, or like we've talked about, those loved ones? What other resources can they find there?
Well, we know the path to recovery looks different for everyone, and some people are not even at the place where they need recovery. So that's where the pause before you play is so important. So it really helps from the beginning in ensuring that those limits are set and that you're making informed decisions about gambling or betting for sports, as well as the path for individuals who might be running into some issues, taking a stop and exploring the resources through GamFin, which really explores financial literacy. We have GamBan, which is a blocking software for mobile devices, phone, computer, and then other resources such as Gamblers Anonymous connections, as well as then individual and group therapy. So we know that the path for recovery looks different for everyone, and we want to make sure that there's a variety of resources available to really meet all those needs.
Derek Longmire with the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio, as we look ahead to a big week in golf here in Central Ohio. It's important to remember those resources are there and available for folks that may be concerned about gambling or maybe want to learn a little more before they place that first wager. Derek, is there anything else that we didn't touch on yet?
I will just mention another resource is the Ohio Problem Gambling Helpline, and that number is 800-589-9966. And we have specialists available 24/7, 365 days a year to help both the gambler as well as their loved ones better navigate those resources. So again, great resources available in the state. And really our goal is to make sure that all Ohioans know about those resources and that it's routed to those who need them.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Derek.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Fan.
It is estimated that more than 1 million Ohioans suffer from eczema. Our state's cold, dry air and indoor heating this winter has also caused Ohioans to have dry skin. As much as 60% of our middle-aged and elderly population are suffering from these conditions, but there's a big difference between dry skin and eczema. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective, dermatologist Dr. Omar Noor and eczema patient advocate Jennifer Etienne. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi.
Dr. Noor, what is the difference between dry skin and eczema as a diagnosis?
So the biggest thing to remember is that if your hands are red, they're cracked, even if they're blistering for more than 3 months, or if it just keeps coming back, this is not just dry skin. That could be chronic hand eczema, and you really don't have to live with it.
So what is the difference between eczema as just an overview and chronic hand eczema, which before this interview, I'd never heard of that?
Which is very reasonable, and a lot of my patients come in with that same thought process. Now, when you have eczema, it typically affects your whole body, and you could grow up with eczema, you can have eczema as a child, or you can develop it as an adult. Where chronic hand eczema differs is that it is specifically around your hands, and it tends to feel different. It doesn't just have to be itchy. It can be painful. It can be thicker. Your hands can even blister. And this is something that is constantly recurring more frequently than the eczema that is on your body.
So if somebody in the winter, for example, and this happens to me, it happened to my mother as well, the fingertips split in the winter. Is that dry skin or is that on the spectrum of eczema?
So, Jay, that is one of the most common reasons my patients come in, because as you are well aware, that split in that finger is so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And that pain, these patients wake up, think of how much you use your hands. Within even the first hour of waking up, every individual moment that you're brushing your teeth, you're washing your hands, you're getting ready for the day is painful, is uncomfortable. That is chronic hand eczema, and it is its own distinct diagnosis. I'm not going to get into the nuance of the science, but really that crack in your finger is due to inflammation under the skin.
Now, does that also affect the feet?
So it can definitely affect the feet as well, and that thickening and those cracks that you get in your feet, though chronic hand eczema is strictly talking about the hands, the palms, as well as the wrists.
So what are the triggers that might worsen the symptoms?
So a lot of patients have different triggers. Some patients will have triggers by washing their hands very frequently, as you would expect. Healthcare workers see this more frequently. If you're a hairdresser and you work with your hands often, if your hands get wet and dry, if you're a construction worker, you tend to have higher rates of chronic hand eczema. And then if you're just have allergies to certain things that you're getting into contact with. I have a chef that comes in. He's allergic to nickel, and he has chronic hand eczema. So there's a whole variety of triggers for different people.
So this suggests that there is some form of an internal mechanism that is affecting the external epidermis, correct?
That's exactly right. I like to say that your genetics, that's the gun, and that loads the gun. But the triggers are what fires that gun and causes your hands to flare.
All right, so Jennifer, you have chronic hand eczema, CHE. How did you find out that you had it, and what is your life experience as a result? What are you doing about it?
I found out that I had it. So I was diagnosed with regular eczema at 8 years old. I was only used to it being in the inner folds of my arms and the back of my knees. But when I got to high school, then I started to notice that the rash was like spreading on my hands, which is not a place that I was used to it being. So when I went into the dermatologist, he just said, it's just eczema. I went on my own research and found out there's seven different types of eczema. And then I realized, oh, this is chronic hand eczema, which is different from the regular eczema on my arms, which I was used to. And, you know, regular treatment that I was using on my arms wasn't working for my hand eczema. And for me, that's the thing that caused me to realize, like, oh, this is different from what I was just struggling with before, which was just on the back of my knees and in the inner folds of my hand arms.
So how are things today?
Things are way better, like so much better. I'm able to wash dishes. Sometimes I have to be careful because I do love using hot water. But for the most part, I'm able to wash dishes without using gloves. If I do notice that my skin is starting to get dry, like just regular dry skin, then I'll ease up on the water temperature and also putting on gloves. And I was able to just get the treatment that is working for me because I found a dermatologist who listened to me, and we came up with the treatment plan for my chronic hand eczema.
If you were to advise someone else who might be struggling with this condition or think they might have the condition or just not know what condition they have and not know what to do about it, what would be your best advice, patient to patient?
I would say go see somebody who knows what they're talking about. See your doctor first, and if they realize, okay, this is not something that they specialize in, get the referral to the dermatologist, who to me is the skin doctor and who will be able to assess your skin. Even then, sometimes they might not be able to, because my dermatologist in high school didn't differentiate that it was chronic hand eczema. But I would firstly say, from patient to patient, go get an opinion, because you may just brush it off as dry skin, but it can be more than that, and you just don't want to have to deal with the constant worrying about washing your hands and dealing with the triggers and everything like that when you can find a treatment plan. But go see a dermatologist, so that way you guys can figure out exactly what it is, what's causing it, and how you guys can treat it.
All right, Dr. Noor, there are a lot of listeners who are interested in this subject, and they love to go online and learn more. What's the best website we can send them to?
Jay, we need more knowledge. Just like you said, there's a lot of people out there that don't realize that this is a condition. Jennifer said it best. Go out there, learn about CHE.com. Knowledge is that first step to make sure you get the right diagnosis.
Sounds like a plan. I've learned something today, gang, and I'll be talking to my primary when I see him the next time, and probably see a dermatologist in Columbus, and I'll update you as to how it goes. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Right now, there are over 2,000 available trade jobs in Columbus and Central Ohio, and most of them are for HVAC. While many workers are experiencing a stagnant job market with fewer job postings and positions that are harder to secure, well-compensated skilled trade job openings keep growing due to infrastructure and other projects that are vital to our economy. Tom Martin is an Ohio-based contractor in Cleveland. He's also national president of the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. And he joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk trade jobs for the Buckeye State. Welcome, Tom. How are you?
Good morning, Jay. Thank you.
So your acronym, how did you say it?
Sheet Metal Air Conditioning Contractors National Association is SMACNA. They refer us to SMACNA contractors.
SMACNA. Okay. That sounds like a child's cereal, but okay. What exactly does your organization do?
We support all of our national contractors around the country, including the state of Ohio, with safety initiatives, technical resources for fabrication standards, welding, and different fabrication standards for sheet metal and architectural metals, installation guidelines and quality control. We also do some legislative work locally and nationally, as well as some labor relations, and assisting our contractors on succession planning and policy and procedures and culture and just building a better company and a better mentorship through our unions and through our contractor association and our contractors.
Now, both my father and my grandfather were in the construction business in Northeast Ohio, and they didn't want me to go into that business. In fact, they wanted me to stay anywhere but that business. What has changed between the 1980s when I went to college and now that has made trade jobs so important? Because it used to be trades were a dirty word.
You're right. The trend is for young men and women to get in a skilled trade and get into a union. Great pay, day one, over $20 to $25 an hour as a first-year apprentice with great benefits. Over $50,000 package, day one. No college debt. And learning a skilled trade, you could travel with that, right? You can if you needed to leave Ohio and go somewhere else, West Coast, East Coast, that trade set, being a plumber, sheet metal worker, HVAC technician, will travel. We're finding also we're really pushing stronger mentorships through our contractors association and through our construction industry. And, you know, we see young men and women build friendships and relationships and peers as they join a union, for example. And it's turn. You're absolutely right. It's turn. It is a trendy industry to get into. Again, you know, that day one, as you're starting to learn this, your trade, and you become an apprentice, you're getting paid pretty good wages with great benefits.
I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, that a staggering number of plumbers and electricians and folks who do that kind of work, just even general handymen, are retiring. Is that why there's such a push to fill these jobs?
Yeah, it's a great point. During COVID, we had a lot of men and women that were leaders within our companies retire. They are fully vested through the union and met requirements for their pension and health and welfare. And so we had to push hard to find, with regards to workforce development, and get new employees into the unions, men and women, via young apprentices, conditional workers, finding welders out there that might want to change and get into a trade to get those high paying wages and great benefits. So yes, we've really pushed on recruiting, retainage, workforce development programs around the state. And yes, it's still a challenge for us. We're still looking for, you know, one challenge for a lot of our bigger contractors in Ohio and around the country is finding future leaders, because we've lost a lot of those men and women to retirement. Finding future 30, 40-year-old men and women that want to be a leader, want to be a shop foreman, a field foreman, superintendent, project manager. So that's challenging, especially with some of these big projects, especially in Columbus. I'm based in Cleveland and Akron, but, you know, Columbus is extremely busy with the data rooms and some of the big projects down there. It is really challenging finding future leaders and just onboarding people in a timely fashion to meet the schedules that these customers are requiring.
Is there room for retirees who want to have a second career? So, for example, let's say somebody who's in their late 50s or early 60s decides they want to leave the industry that they're in now and they want to come into a trade. Is that a possibility?
Yes, it is. Every union handles it a little bit differently, Jay, but yes, we've opened it up for retirees to come back to work for a period of time, maybe job specific or a duration, to help us as contractors meet goals and schedules to get these projects done in a timely manner. So yes, there are opportunities, especially in the MEP trade, the mechanical, electrical, plumbing, sheet metal trades.
I guess my question also was, can someone who is not from that industry, those trades, can they be trained at those upper ages? Can they learn a new skill? And, you know, let's say I'm just going to pick something out of the air. I work in the broadcast industry. I've been doing this for over 40 years. If tomorrow I was no longer able to do this, would I be able to train to become a plumber or an electrician or a shop foreman?
Yes. We might put you on the residential or light commercial side so we can train you quickly and onboard you quickly. Let's say your example, you have some welding background and you like to TIG weld, MIG weld. We probably can bring you in as a conditional type position and as a journeyman and help us weld either in the shop or in the field. So we, as the unions and the contractors, have been very creative and expand onboarding opportunities for a scenario like you just mentioned. We are definitely willing to do that. If you want to be engaged, you want to get involved, for example, and you have a skill set or we think you can get trained relatively quickly and bring value to us, absolutely.
So at the beginning of this interview, I mentioned that there are over 2,000 available trade jobs right now in Columbus, because as you mentioned, you know, Columbus is simply, we call it here at WBNS, we call it a boom town because there's so much construction going on and so much redevelopment. If you were to bullet point or pinpoint, rather, what those jobs might be, what are the most important industries that would be hiring right now in a town like Columbus or in Central Ohio as a metro?
The MEP trades, mechanical, sheet metal, piping, pipe fitting, electrical, and plumbing. I mean, there's the MEP trades, there's supply and demand for it. In Columbus, for example, you have national mechanical contractors coming in from Iowa and Texas and Indiana and all over the place to help man these projects. We do some work down there as well. But I would say the MEP trades, if you want to get into HVAC or sheet metal or plumbing or electrical or pipe fitting and welding, ample opportunities and really we can onboard you relatively quick. The nice thing, Jay, is a lot of our unions have pre-apprentices and helpers now in the collective bargaining agreements where we can onboard a young man or woman or somebody middle age. They have a little skill set. We can onboard them relatively quickly, get them part of the union, get them part of one of the contractors, hit the floor running quickly, and then keep training them as they go through their apprenticeship. Normally, most apprenticeships in the country and in the state of Ohio are a 4-year apprenticeship.
Now you
first year wages are over $20 an hour.
That's what you said.
It's day one. Yeah.
So you're the president of a national association. I'm sitting here in Columbus, Ohio. I would imagine that Ohio is competing for these workers with other states. What do you tell the tradespeople in Ohio? What can they do to be more competitive and be more attractive to potential workers than, say, the folks in, I don't know, Colorado or Oregon or wherever?
Like you, I was born and raised here. Great state, three big cities, has a little bit of everything. Ohio's very diverse. Just great opportunities in this state. Work continues to thrive in the construction industry, not only with the data rooms and the cell and battery plant projects, but a ton of great healthcare, especially up in the Cleveland area. Just great opportunities, and our economy, I think, will be really strong, and there'll be work opportunities. If you want to engage, you want to work hard, there's great opportunities in the state of Ohio.
Enough said. Tom Martin, the national president of, I don't like that acronym. I'm just going to say Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, because it just flows better. We want to thank you for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The 100 deadliest days on the roads. It's from Memorial Day to Labor Day. According to the Ohio State Highway Patrol, during 2025's 100 deadliest days, there were nearly 68,000 crashes on Ohio roads. 351 of those were fatal crashes, resulting in 384 deaths. Now, over the last 5 years, OSHP stats show a steady year-over-year decline in overall traffic deaths in the Buckeye State, from 1,356 in 2021 down to 1,115 in 2025. And now, of course, we are in the heart of Orange Barrel season, and it is a record construction season for the Ohio Department of Transportation. Nearly 1,000 new projects this year, worth $3.4 billion. Joining me now to talk about all of this and more is ODOT Press Secretary Matt Bruning. Matt, thanks for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, so what's the main message heading into this summer travel season as construction season is in full swing?
Yeah, the big message is to pay attention. We've got a lot of work we're doing out there, a lot of investment, I call it, in our infrastructure here in Ohio. And it's important that as we're all driving through those work zones, we're paying extra attention, allowing that extra space in front of us for to be able to react to things that happen in front of us. And, of course, slowing down. And when we see those road crews out there, we want people to move over and slow down for them, give them the room they need to get the job done. But the big thing is, pay attention.
What do you make of the declining number of traffic deaths? I mean, you know, one is always too many, yeah. But we are seeing that steady decline every year for the last 5 years.
Well, and you're right. You know, we celebrate the fact that we are seeing fewer and fewer people dying on Ohio roads. That is certainly something to be thankful for. But we're still having too many. More than 1,000 people dying on our roadways is just unacceptable. And so we will continue to do all we can from the engineering portion and the educating portion of things and do what we can at ODOT. But we also need drivers to do some very basic things, and that is obeying the speed limit, make sure you're buckled up, make sure you're driving sober, and put those distractions down.
Yeah, it'd be 14 deaths last year, I believe, over Memorial Day weekend alone.
Yeah, yeah, it's just unacceptable.
Well, let's talk about the construction season, first of all. $3.4 billion for about 977 projects. So what is the focus of the projects?
A lot of it is preservation. So it's not us building a lot of new things. It's taking care of what we already have out there. ODOT's main mission is obviously to oversee our transportation network across the state of Ohio. ODOT's responsible for all the state and U.S. routes outside municipalities and all of the interstates in the state of Ohio except for the Ohio Turnpike. So that is a responsibility we take very seriously, and that's what this $3.4 billion represents, is maintaining that highway system and roadway system, but also where it makes sense to add some capacity and expand things, certainly we will.
Well, let's talk about adding capacity, because mm-hmm. Central Ohio is certainly adding capacity when yep. it comes to population. How much of the focus of these projects is about keeping up with growth here in this, and particularly in Central
yeah,
Ohio?
When you look at that $3.4 billion, about 80 cents of every dollar we invest is preservation. The remaining 20 cents is for enhancing capacity. So that could be something as simple as a turn lane. But it could also be something as simple as a huge flyover ramp like we see downtown here in Columbus. So we're always looking for ways to make the roadways safer, but also more efficient movers of traffic.
Let's talk about that flyover ramp. What is the latest on the 70-71 split that's been going on for years and still has quite a few years left?
Still got quite a few years left. We're probably looking past 2030 before all of that is done. There are some segments of that that have not yet been funded. But, you know, we've seen some big changes down there, and I think those changes have made a huge difference. When you look at where that project started, that was one of the most dangerous sections of highways in the state of Ohio between the two splits there at 70-71. And so we've been able to untangle some of those weaves to where now, for example, if you're going from Cincinnati to Cleveland, you stay on the right side of the highway and not have to cross across two or three lanes of traffic to continue on northbound on 71. So just trying to separate that traffic out right there has made it much safer.
Matt Bruning with ODOT, thank you so much for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State, a new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.